I chose to say no. To say, you know, enough's enough. I did my 4 years. I'm sorry for doing even that much. And I'm getting off this merry-go-round or whatever at this point. You know, in my mind, it was more like whatever they could do to me was relatively insignificant to what was going to happen, without a doubt, to tens or hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle East. And I think we probably all know about the 1.5 million Iraqi people that have died since then, not because of bombings or any nuclear warhead that we unleashed on them, although we continue to threaten to do so, but because of the continuing sanctions against the people of Iraq.
Speculation of a U.S.-led assault on Iraq has increased ever since President Bush declared in his State of the Union address that Iraq was part of an axis of evil. In early July 2002, the New York Times reported on a classified Pentagon document which lays out advanced plans for a three-pronged simultaneous attack on Iraq by air, land, and sea, which would include over 250,000 U.S. troops. The paper is a step-by-step blueprint for combat operations that the Pentagon defines as a war plan. At a July 8th news conference, the president refused to comment on the leaked document, but reaffirmed his administration's stated policy of regime change in Iraq, saying, quote, "We'll use all tools at our disposal to do so," end quote. These recent developments do not sit well with progressives, who point out that more than 1.5 million people have died since the start of the Gulf War in 1991. As well, invading Iraq would be a violation of international law. Under the UN Charter and Security Council Resolution 687, only the Security Council is empowered to authorize the use of force in Iraq. No mandate for an invasion of Iraq has been forthcoming from the Security Council, whose veto-wielding members include Russia, China, and France, all opposed to military action against Iraq. In 1990, Jeff Patterson was a corporal in the Marine Corps and had received extensive training in the use of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. During his time in the Marines, Jeff became increasingly disillusioned with the U.S. military's interventions in foreign affairs. In August of that year, Jeff found himself stationed in Hawaii with just a few weeks left in a 4-year enlistment. Because of his nuclear artillery experience, Jeff was one of the first to be deployed to Saudi Arabia as a part of Operation Desert Shield. With the help of some anti-war activists he had met, Jeff decided to oppose the war, stating at a press conference on August 16, 1990, quote, "I will not be a pawn in America's power plays for profits and oil in the Middle East. I will refuse to board the plane, and if I am dragged out into the Saudi desert, I will refuse to fight," end quote. 2 weeks later, and 6 days into a hunger strike, Jeff was ordered to board a military transport plane bound for Saudi Arabia. Sticking to his earlier promise, Jeff Patterson sat down on the runway. Jeff Patterson spoke on July 9, 2002, in Santa Cruz, California, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
In 1986, I joined the Marine Corps because I had nothing better to do with my life. I grew up in Hollister, which is over the hill a bit. Sort of wanted to go to school, but wasn't sure what I wanted to be when I grew up. I sort of wanted to do some traveling and see some stuff, but wasn't sure where I was going to get the money to do that. And all of those worries evaporated. All I had to do was sign on the dotted line, and these guys would take care of me. I would do my part, and in return, they would take care of me. And I'd get to go to school as I was in the Marines, and I'd learn a trade. I specifically asked them to put me where I was most needed, and that turned out to be a field artillery controller And later I was trained in assembling the field artillery nuclear warheads, and I was sent to biological and chemical training school also. And over the next 3 years, I got to see the Philippines, Okinawa, Japan, South Korea, and that's where I spent the vast majority of my 4-year enlistment. And it was only then did I start to question what exactly I was doing and what I was doing with my life. You know, some of the examples I can point to is going around in our 5-ton trucks, pulling our artillery cannons around the island of Okinawa. And sometimes we throw candy off the back of the trucks as we go through a small town to kids. And the kids would always, you know, raise their fingers. There'd always be somebody in the truck that respond with, "Yeah, two bombs, little gooks," and we'd all laugh. And if you didn't laugh, then you're kind of thought of, well, the outsider. So you kind of had to go along and chuckle, ha ha. Sort of, you wanted to stay in good with the rest of the people. You didn't want to become the guy that became the guy who got volunteered for all the crappy stuff and digging the ditches and burning the latrines. And, you know, I always wanted somebody else to do all that crap. When I went to the Philippines, many people, you know, may be aware of it, but you know, some still don't, which is amazing to me. But just the prostitution villages and the bars and whatnot that sprung around thousands of bars and brothels around every substantial U.S. base in the Philippines, but particularly Subic Bay. And that's a concern, again, for the people of the Philippines as the U.S. is now re-entering the Philippines after being basically kicked out by the Filipino people. And then, after seeing all that, and then reading about what was going on in Central America, we were always told that everything we were doing in my artillery unit was to prepare for our eventual need, and it was just assumed that it would happen eventually when the communists overran El Salvador, and we'd have to go in and save them, or we have to go down to Nicaragua and kick ass with the Sandinistas. I then, out of kind of a whim, and I got bored of going to E-Club and getting drunk most evenings, I went to the base library and found a book on Nicaragua, and which led, you know, gave me some small insight as to why these basically peasants would dare fight against what, you know, I was part of the meanest, toughest war machine on earth, and how would these people that are worth nothing or whatever dare stand up against our military might? And it was interesting in that I sort of then saw myself as, what would I do in their position? What would I do if I was a a worker on one of these plantations with, you know, all the profits not only going to the local bureaucrats, but most of the profits then being bled out of the country to U.S. corporations. And I'm sure all that situation's even worse now with, you know, NAFTA and globalization and whatnot. So I began to think, well, maybe if I was ordered to go to El Salvador, when I got down there, maybe I just take off and hide in the bushes. I wouldn't actually have to fight. And maybe, you know, I'd be really cool to the people there, and maybe they'd like put me up until the war was over or something. And I started thinking that, not because, you know, what I read, but my buddy started coming back from doing tours and training in Costa Rica. We were directly training the Contra death squads that were operating in northern Nicaragua, and in Costa Rica we were also training the paramilitaries of El Salvador. At that time, my sergeant, you know, we'd often get drunk, which we did only 4, 5, or 6 times a week. And one time, he was recounting all the good old days of doing tours of embassy duty in Beirut, where you got to see real shit and shoot at real people, and that's what we get paid for. But the one thing he was actually had some remorse about, or kind of one of the things that haunted him, is he was pulling embassy duty for a year in San Salvador. And he was guarding the perimeter like he did most nights. And there was he found a teenage boy, probably like 15 years old, too near the perimeter or right inside the perimeter or whatever. And, you know, as what was expected of him, he arrested the kid, interrogated him for his terrorist connections. It was assumed he was doing reconnaissance of the embassy. And then, you know, they tied him up and they beat him, not too bad. But then they turned him over to the local, not police, but the local paramilitaries. And this guy, as he got more and more drunk, kept just saying, you know, well, yeah, you know, he was one of the bodies in the ditch in the morning, but that's not my fault. I was just doing my job. And that was a very common thing for the paramilitaries to round up suspected subversives in El Salvador at the time and dump them along the street as an example to the rest. So that's where I was coming from when I finally got to Hawaii at the end of my 4-year enlistment, thinking, well, I've seen all this crappy stuff around the world, and thank God I'm American. I get to go back to America where things are nice and pleasant. We don't have to live in ditches, and or in the Philippines, we'd shoot our artillery rounds, and they would explode out on the bombing range, and people would come out of kind of basically caves on the bombing range, and between our volleys of artillery, they would collect the shrapnel from our artillery rounds to sell in the recycling market or whatever. And we'd often, you know, laugh about, you know, how crappy it is to shoot here because, you know, everyone, we'd have to, like, stop shooting every other round to let the gooks go collect the metal. But anyways, all that was behind me. I had a few months to serve on my enlistment. I got a nice, cushy job out in Hawaii. And based on all those things I saw, I wanted to read up more about, you know, El Salvador and Nicaragua and more about the Philippines and Korea. You know, I spent a whole year in Okinawa, Japan, but maybe I spent, you know, 4 or 5 days actually in the cities of Japan. Maybe I ate in an actual Japanese restaurant 2 or 3 times in the, you know, 400 days I was there. It was so easy, you know, you didn't have to leave the base. There was a movie theater, there was Burger King, and there was a McDonald's, so there was variety. You know, but I knew people protested at the gates. I knew, you know, the farmers were always complaining something about, you know, land being stolen from them, some whining about the U.S. occupying, you know, having 17 or 18 major military installations on an island that's like 80 miles long and between 5 and 10 miles wide, of the U.S., you know, military occupying the majority of the farmable land in Okinawa. And, you know, they're always whining about something, and we were told, you know, we were ordered never to talk to those people. It wasn't that you should not talk to them. It's like, if we see you talking to them, you're in trouble. So I ended up in Hawaii, and the first thing I am ordered to do is go out to the island of Ko'olawe and bomb it. Basically, the entire island had been bombed for the previous 40 years to a point where the water table, because of all native vegetation, had been blown into the sea, and the water table was no longer existent. The military had a PR campaign where they set up little planting areas of a few dozen square feet to reclaim this land. And these planting areas would be in the middle of the island, and they put up like a little picket fence. And this was on the map that they gave to the pilots of the island. The island was a target, but there was little dots around the map, so no bombing on this dot, no bombing on this arable of this farm plot land dot here, no bombing on this sacred Hawaiian shrine here, no bombing on this sacred Hawaiian shrine, which I think there was like over approximately 150 native Hawaiian shrines, because down at the Kohalawe by many Native Hawaiians, and their religion is the birthplace of mankind. The gods created man out of the dirt on that island, which, of course, has been bombed into the ocean. So we bombed the island some more, and I didn't think about it much because it was already a barren wasteland. But then, after 2 weeks of bombing it, I was then ordered to clean it up for 2 weeks because that was a PR thing that the military was doing at the time, saying, we're good neighbors, we're cleaning up after our mess. But I soon realized that there was planes, there was these bombers bombing the island, and there was me and eight guys with leather sacks, and we'd line up shoulder to shoulder and bend over and pick up shrapnel. And I never ran across a square foot of the island that didn't have shrapnel on it. So we could literally stand and bend over in one place for a few minutes and pick up the shrapnel. And then we would eventually, you know, at the beginning of the day, we'd pick up everything larger than a dime. And then by noon, we'd be picking up everything larger than a nickel. And then by the afternoon, it was like anything twice as big as a quarter, I'm picking up, and screw the rest. Basically, it was a public relations campaign. And oftentimes, we would get word over the walkie-talkie to find shelter because there's a bombing run nearby, and shrapnel's going to be raining upon us any second again. I met some Native Hawaiian people, in part around the University of Hawaii and an alternative coffee house that existed there at the time. And that gave me a great insight as to another perspective on that. I also met people that had also been to Central America, not as part of the military, but as part of international brigades to help the Nicaraguan people against the Contra War and whatnot. And all that was academic, and I learned a lot, and I felt good that I was really I was smarter than most of my coworkers, who were bumbling idiots. And I was getting out, I was going to go to college. But the Gulf War happened. You know, my best friend got at the same time. I took him to the airport, and the next day, if he was like one day later, he would have been called back, and he would have had to go also to the Gulf. I basically put together what I had was a pretty, what I thought was a pretty thorough hatred of everything I'd been part of for the last 4 years. And also, we've been told over and over again how much we're going to help the people of Central America to come to their rescue. And now I was being told that I was going to come to the rescue of the people of Iraq and Kuwait, and we were just going to go over there and make sure that the new Hitler doesn't go any further, that we'd be the tripwire. After 4 years of doing what you're told every day and realizing that's the easiest way to get through life, I was basically still ready to go. And I was packing my bags like everybody else. Battalion commander, he knew people were worried. Nobody wanted to go off to the other side of the world. Thanksgiving was coming up. People had taken weeks off for Christmas. They had their leave approved. So he had to have a pep talk. And the pep talk basically, the punchline, which I remember very well, was, you know, if anything goes wrong over there, we'll whip out the silver bullet and nuke all the ragheads until they glow. Well, the silver bullet was the artillery-fired nuclear shell, and I was the primary person certified to assemble the silver bullet. So it became clear to me that there was more at stake than my just passively going along shooting at people, maybe being shot or whatever, is that flashing through all those pictures of training of the people, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and everything I'd seen in nuclear chemical school. And, you know, I went to the training, and I was ordered to, you know, assemble the rounds, and we practiced blowing up a balloon and sending it into the air, making sure the wind was blowing the other way before we gave the command to fire the artillery nuclear round, because artillery only goes 5 or 6 miles. So we had to make sure that the wind was blowing away from us at the time. And I soon envision myself very clearly as the guy who was in the middle and part of that. So that's basically why I chose to say no, to say, enough's enough. I did my 4 years. I'm sorry for doing even that much. And I'm getting off this merry-go-round or whatever at this point. In my mind, it was more like whatever they could do to me was relatively insignificant to what was going to happen, without a doubt, to tens or hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle East. And I think we probably all know about the 1.5 million Iraqi people that have died since then, not mainly because of bombings or any nuclear warhead that we unleashed on them, although we continue to threaten to do so, but because of the continuing sanctions against the people of Iraq. Interesting part is, while people are like, well, didn't people want to kick my ass, or and they call me a fag and a queer and a coward and a traitor and an un-American and all kinds of other cool stuff. And yeah, they did. But more interesting was the people who actually who helped me out in the military. The black guys that saw me as the opposition to the lifer goons that ran around making their life miserable. Like, the deal in the military was that, there was a handful of lifers. Most of us wanted to get through our 4 years and get the hell out of there. We had all been promised money for college and whatnot, and we all realized long ago that was mainly BS. We all were promised these great jobs, and we all realized, since we were in artillery, that we weren't gonna get no artillery job after we got out. So it was basically us trying to get through versus the lifers. And like, one time, for months, I've lived in a dorm with three people, and there was a black guy from Louisiana who were, I was pretty good friends with, but not best buddies or anything, and a white guy, also from the South. So the white guy, he puts up, one day he puts up the Stars and Bars flag in the dorm, and the black guy, he's sort of pissed off about that. He's like, fuck that, man. So he goes out to the record store and buys a Malcolm X poster and puts a Malcolm X poster up there. So the next day, we come back from eating at the mess hall, and we walk in, something's different, and we look up at the wall, and the Malcolm X poster just had little torn corners left where the tape was. So we're like, what the hell is up with that? And so the guy's all, he's pissed off, and I'm kind of just curious. We go around to the sergeant of the day, and like, what the hell happened to my poster? Somebody stole my poster. And the guy's like, no, I took that down. It's racist. And he's like, what about the Stars and Bars? What about that? It was a slave flag. And the sergeant's like, well, boy, that's heritage. So that was part of the scene. It was very easy for, there was all, people pissed off about being screwed out of benefits and being screwed out of education and all this crap. But it was always, my sergeant's the biggest dick in the world, but down at Bravo Company, they have a cool sergeant. If only we could, get transferred to Bravo Company. And from what I know, Bravo Company was saying the same thing. If only I could get transferred to Alpha Battery. But that's where the things were at. So when I came along and said, I'm not going to be a pawn for, oil and profit in the Middle East, and I'm out there on TV, and people are like, man, you're just like spitting out all kinds of crazy science or whatever. I don't agree with you or whatever, but, it's kind of cool watching all the lifers, shit and be pissed off about this. So people helped me sneak out when I was under house arrest. I was pending charges against me for releasing classified material to the enemy. And that was basically when I held a press conference, I said I was going to be deployed soon. So they said, well, you told Saddam Hussein that Alpha Battery is going to be going to Iraq. So that was classified. And, of course, you could read the local newspaper and you could find out a lot more than that. But that was one of the charges. While I was in the general's office waiting to be yelled at by the general or the colonel or whatever, whoever was the yelly at the day, the peon in charge, the secretary, basically whispered in my ear that he had shredded my security clearance, the official classified clearance papers for me. So there's no way that they'd be able to charge me now with that. And he said, "Well, don't get me wrong, you know, I don't agree with what you're doing, but you know, I'm just fuck that old man. I'm tired of this shit." Right. Another time I was I was asleep. I was under house arrest, like I was for a good part of the time, after I publicly said I would refuse to fight. And these three guys climb through the window, and they're poking me with sticks, maybe a baseball bat or an axe handle. We had all kinds of them laying around. And we're like, "Wake up, you fucking faggot. We're going to kill you now." I'm like thinking, so I'm like really tired. I'm like, why? Why are you going to kill me? You know, what did I do? So the first thing I could think of, I sort of started launching into, "Well, did you know that, you know, Saddam Hussein gassed Kurds with, you know, U.S. and German supplied gas canisters, and did you know that the U.S. you know, protected those tankers, you know, through the Strait of Hormuz, and did you know?" I was just kind of just rattling off things in my sleep. "You know, the U.S. you know, supported Saddam Hussein for 10 years of villainy and massacring Kurdish people." It's quite going on and on, so they get a chance to decide whether, all right, now we're going to kill him. They just kept rattling off this stuff. And then finally, are like, And then they're like, "Well, all right, so you're not a faggot, and you're doing this for a reason, I guess. So in that case, all right." And then they took off. The next day, the guy comes back, the guy that visited me the night before, and he had there's this funky leaflet where he took my picture from a newspaper, just an ugly little picture, and posted it like 5 times, and he had his handprint, and he outlined his hand like in nursery school. And it said, "Free Patterson, Free Jeff Patterson" on it. And again, he wanted to point out that he wasn't doing it because of me or anything, but because he wanted to make the captain shit. He put these around the PX, and he just wanted to like see their face when they saw this, and so all the lifers would shit. And finally, you know, one time, you know, these reactionary goons did come for me when I was, you know, basically the night came when I was supposed to get on the airplane. I was volunteered to be the first to go. You're volunteered to do a lot of stuff in the military, and I was volunteered to be the first to go, despite, you know, my application for discharge as a conscientious objector and all that kind of stuff. So we're all gathered around in our barracks. It was the evening, and nobody was allowed to go because we're all on alert. So there's like 100 people in this little room. And these white guys are like, "Yeah, now we're going to fucking kill Patterson, the goddamn faggot coward." A couple of the black guys, they, you know, I'd sort of known, but we're not, you know, tight or anything. They're like, "Man, leave him alone. You know, quit fucking with him. You know, he's got his reasons, whatever the hell they are." And these white guys are, you know, coming for me. I'm like, "All right, I'm going to get my ass kicked here." But the white guys turn to the black guys and they're like, "Get the fuck out of my way, you niggers." And it was at that point, I then had a posse of 40 people protecting me. You know, that was kind of the dynamic. They took me out of the barracks to a Jeep. And as as I'm being escorted out, I had the colonel on my side, I had a captain, I had 2 staff sergeants surrounding me, walking me to the Jeep to make sure I get to the Jeep. And from the balcony, there's like hundreds of people lining on the balcony, and they're saying, "Good, you know, party's over." You know, they saw me as a celebrity, basically. And, you know, somebody spit on me, and there's like this big green loogie kind of down my face, but, you know, whatever. But then I looked over at the colonel, and he had like 3 loogies rolling down his face. And I looked over at the staff sergeant, and there was like spit kind of running off his hat. And there was all this spit, you know, there was like spit on me, there was spit on the colonel, there was spit on the staff sergeant, on the sergeant. And half the people up to the barracks started chanting like, "Kill, kill, kill." And like, you know, it like seemed like a good showing, like another dozens or so people started chanting, "Peace, peace, peace." So there's this whole kill piece and people spitting on me, people spitting on the colonel. It was like a, it was a great scene. Well worth whatever indignities I had to go through. I was taken out to the airstrip and the airplane pulled up. I was ordered to get on, and after some back and forth, I ended up sitting down on the runway. And people started jumping around and yelling at me. I was throwing away my life. They had proof that communists had given me two women, that had convinced me to do so, that activists had given me large sums of money to convince me to do this. Well, basically, that's what, you know, what else? How else could the military explain why you would do anything, whether it wasn't for money or prostitutes or sex, right? That's about it. What else do you do things for? Especially potentially go to jail. And then after I ignored all that, then they said, well, you know, one more last chance. You know, if you get up and get on the plane now, you're going to be one of the Banded Brothers, and, you know, we'll forget all this mess ever happened. And after I ignored them, they said, well, all right, when we come back, we're going to form a hit team, and we're going to hunt you down, and we're going to kill you in a dark alley. I'm like, no. Still, I'm not getting on the damn plane. Now I was taken to the brig. After a few months, the military basically backed down and released me in the middle of my trial because they had a war to fight, because a relatively small number of people, much like yourself, came to my defense, particularly in Hawaii, but other places around the country. And the anti-war movement was picking up steam. It was still December. The bombing was still a couple of months away. And the military saw it would be easier for them to prepare to fight their war by just discharging me. So instead of doing the 5 years or whatever I sort of assumed I would do in Leavenworth, I ended up being turned out into the streets of San Francisco. I helped edit, publish a newsletter called The Anti-Warrior that tried to give a voice to the other people that came after me who refused to fight. And a few of them told me, well, when I saw you on CNN or whatever, you know, I knew I had to do that too. So I kind of felt, well, you know, I don't want to get him in trouble and not help him. So I did this newsletter. I actually just put a lot of, most of it, it's now archived on my website. If you want to read it, it has articles from and mentions and talks about almost 100 people in the U.S. Military that were imprisoned during the Gulf War for refusing to fight. The U.S. military estimated that 3,500 people in the U.S. military applied for discharges during that period as conscientious objectors. During my efforts to gain support for these resistors, I was in contact with Ron Dellums, who was the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee for the Armed Forces at the time, which was very bizarre, but he told us that actually the number was closer to 7,500, and that the military often, you know, half the time the military, you give them a discharge, say I'm a conscientious objector, and they would take that and they would crumple it up and throw it in the garbage and basically say, you know, if I ever see anything like that again, we're going to kick your ass. So unless you had some kind of outside connection that you could say, well, I already told my attorney or whatever, you know, you're more likely than not just to like, oh, okay, I'll do what I'm told. So I tell my story sometimes in high schools and, you know, in Oakland High, and I was down in San Luis Obispo recently. And, you know, high school kids were like, yeah, you know, who cares? You know, you got a nice story. We hear old people come in here all the time with nice stories. And I say, well, you're right. You know, when I was 18 years old, I sort of knew about, you know, like strange experiments that the military had done on World War II people around radiation tests and exploding nuclear bombs by them to see what would happen and see if they would grow a third eye or whatever. I sort of knew about this thing called Agent Orange that had been sprayed all over Vietnam and it was causing birth defects in veterans. But I thought, this is 1986. You know, that's ancient history. This is 1986. They would never do such a thing now. But I talked to him about Gulf War illness, about tens of thousands of vets who have applied for disability because of their service in the Gulf War because they were exposed unnecessarily to the chemical explosions of actual enemy bunkers. They were shot up with experimental vaccines that had not yet been approved for human use. They were given just bags of pills to take in case of a nerve agent attack, and just to take a couple a day, just in case. And that more than one person told me that, you know, their local Navy corpsman told them to take four or five a day. You'd be double safe. They set up kiddie pools and filled the kiddie pools with insecticide to keep the bugs off you. So instead of, you know, rubbing on your skin, people would just get naked, jump in the pool, roll over in and out. And it was a much more efficient way of processing people and getting people safe from the insects. And then the kicker, the favorite ammunition that's supposed to save your life, to kill the enemy, is just as likely to kill you over the long run. The depleted uranium munitions, it was no secret. And, you know, if you were in the know, I read about some of this stuff when I was still in the military and how it was sort of dangerous and whatnot. But all that was in the subversive literature that I was reading on the side. It wasn't in the Army Times. It wasn't our instruction on how to use these weapons. And now this depleted uranium, which is great because we get to use the nuclear waste, right? It's a recycle, you know, it's recycling, earth friendly. And yet, these veterans are coming back. They're trying to get a treatment for Gulf War syndrome. And yet, military says, well, we haven't pinpointed the one thing. You know, we're working on it. We're doing studies. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to kind of extrapolate that, well, maybe the combination of these half a dozen things, all very dangerous and obviously worth studying in their own right, has produced this. And the VA has learned nothing from the Agent Orange situation, except maybe hold out until many of these people die and then there'll be less claims. And then, you know, people still join the military for real reasons. Well, one is the $500 million budget for recruitment. You know, sometimes it's $1 billion when they're desperate for people. There's now a thing called the Army of One. You're an Army of One. If you're watching football, that's the new Army slogan. Not be all you can be, but you're an Army of One. Basically, like, you know, well, you go in the military and you don't really have to do what they tell you because you're an Army of One or whatever. And if you see the TV commercials, there's a 1-800 number you call. And you call the 1-800 number and they're sending out 1.5 million of these packages. And there's only two things in that package. One is a T-shirt that says Army on the back. It says Army of One. And there's a video that's a 20-minute video. It has a great kind of a hard rock, progressive, grunge soundtrack through the entire 20 minutes. It's called 212 Ways to Be a Soldier. And it's 20 minutes long. And some of the quotes, I got three little small quotes from this video. So here's a quote from a 19-year-old woman that appears in the video. It says, "Probably if I hadn't joined the Army, I would be doing the same thing that most of my friends are doing, which is working fast food," you know, as she's, you know, in an important position. "Basically," says a male reservist, "I get to play James Bond in the Army. I participate in stuff like conducting liaison interviews with potential spies. I love my job. It'll also help in my civilian job, and then I'll get to work a lot with computers." And then finally, a woman pilot. These videos are always very multicultural. They have a lot of women in strong roles or whatever, just to point out that it's nothing like the real military. "The mission of the CAV, the Airborne Cavalry, mission of the CAV is to spot the enemy," says the woman pilot. "It's cool, too, because we get to engage the enemy as well with guns and everything on our aircraft. It's a challenge, and it's like, really, it's a lot of fun. Heck, what other job can I fire weapons like this in?" You know, all this to, you know, a rock and roll soundtrack. You know, and then they have the audacity to, like, tell people who apply for conscientious objectors, "Well, you knew what you were getting into. Like, based on that video, you knew? Like, what the hell are they talking about?" Basically, you should have known you're a sucker, that we're going to screw you. A big thing on this video is people want to go to college. And like me, I plan on going to college. And if I joined up, maybe I'd go to college at night. But the fact is, well, one, you have to pay $1,200 to enter their program. You have to pay $100 out of your first 12 paychecks to be in the GI Bill. Statistically, 65% of the people who join the GI Bill will never get a dime in return. Two-thirds will give the government $1,200 to be in this program, and yet will never get a dime in return. The program is completely non-refundable. If anything happens to you in the military, if you get a discharge that is not an honorable discharge, which a third of the people in the military will get, you're screwed. If you get a medical discharge prior to like 2 years of service, you're screwed. If you just say, hey, I changed my mind, I'm never going to go to college, well, you're screwed. Of the people, of the one-third of people who pay their $1,200 and do use the program, only a third of that third will ever get a four-year degree and use the maximum allowed money, which is about $14,500. And basically, that is a set amount you will get every month that you're going to school over a four-year period. Most people who do use the program will go to a two-year technical school, and the maximum they will ever receive is about $7,200. So for the majority of people, which is the minority of people who get anything, they'll come out after 4, 5, 3, 6 years, they'll come out at $5,000 ahead. And that's 4 years is a lot of work for $5,000, even for artillery guys. What they always advertise is the Army Navy College Fund, which is $40,000 for school. And it's true, but it's you serve 4 years and you get a scholarship. But the vast majority of people are not going to be officers. They're not going to be officers in the Army or the Navy. They're going to join out of that vague promise or whatever. They're going to be told to sign up for the GI Bill. Which is basically what people did. You sign here. Don't be an idiot. Sign up here. And that's it. And then people are thinking, well, at least I'll have some job training after I get out. Well, the Veterans Administration did a survey of tens of thousands of people after they got out of the military. And they asked people, you know, was the training you received in the military helpful in your future career? The average male veteran, 14%, said that the training they received was helpful. When they asked women that same question, it dropped down to 8%. The majority of the 14% who said it was helpful were security guards, sheriff, highway patrol. That was their job. Me, for instance, I had extensive training in field artillery and nuclear warfare, and also with some supply chain stuff. I helped run the supply department for a little bit. And I was sent to school, and we learned this, basically this inventory keeping. And more than once, the guy running the class made this great point of, all right, you guys listen now. This is going to be helpful for when you get out. We use the same software that Kmart uses. And I think he was the only person out of all my training claimed that something he was teaching me was going to be helpful in my future career as a Kmart stock boy. But but that's the deal. You know, in these videos, they often show people, they often will show black women, very politically correct or whatever, talking about how much great fun she has with her buddies and whatnot. The fact is, you live in this environment. You know, if you're in the Philippines, whatever, you're surrounded by basically a condescending attitude towards women, prostitution, you know, where people basically, it was okay to basically give the, you know, you find a girlfriend, i.e. a prostitute, you give her parents a large appliance, and that would basically purchase her for your few months there, and the family would feed you. You know, that was kind of the situation. And then to say that women could just jump in there and like be equals and your buddy-buddy is just strange or whatever. Statistically, some of these same Veterans Administration surveys, women who got out of the military, 90% said that they had been sexually harassed while in the military. And I find that kind of strange. I'm like, what the hell were those other 10% doing? I can't even imagine, you know, a woman going one day without being sexually harassed in the military. So there, I think those other 10% were kind of fudging it. But obviously the most shocking thing is, you know, a third of the women reported being raped while in the military. And then you're thinking, well, yeah, you know, Saddam Hussein's guys, you know, capture them. And, you know, well, no, that's not the case. They were raped by fellow co-workers. And that statistically, that happened to one out of three women in the military. Some things to think about for people who are thinking about joining up. Obviously, the Central Committee for Conscience Objectors has a lot more stuff on their website. Well, anyways, I usually end up with a little pitch to support people who refuse to fight, support the future resistors of this oncoming promised war without end against axes of evil and evildoers around the world, and evildoers who now may be U.S. citizens who we are told are too dangerous to be tried in open civilian courts and need to be shunted off to military trials and to be suspicious of foreign-looking people, and especially if they're from the Middle East, but not if they're from Saudi Arabia, which is our ally, even though those are the people that, you know, mainly brought down the Twin Towers. We do need to, like, plant the pole that we will support the soldiers that refuse to fight, and that we oppose what's being done in our name by our government. Right now I'm working on this project called Not in Our Name, and we've had a couple protests already, and like in Berkeley we've rented the Berkeley Community Theater for September 11th. We're going to have an anti-war concert with Michael Frenti and hopefully some other bands, so maybe hopefully you'll hear more about that and come up. I just want to finish up by reading the Pledge of Resistance. So this is the Not in Our Name Pledge of Resistance. We believe that as people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will we wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will we invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our name will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not by our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have come under attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. So that's my wrap.
And that was Jeff Patterson, Gulf War Refusenik. He spoke on July 9th, 2002, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, California. For more information about conscientious objector status, or to read articles and opinions about nonviolent solutions to war, visit Jeff Patterson's website at www.jeff.patterson.net. That's www.jeff.patterson.net. And the music on this program was performed by Palehead with the song I Will Refuse from the 1988 Wax Trax release entitled Trait. From the studios of Freak Radio Santa Cruz, my name's the V-Man. Thanks for listening.